Spoke with artist Tima Stoffer August 9th at the Hudson Opera House, the venue for the exhibition Tima Stoffer Upstate. To view the full WGXC programming schedule, make a one-time donation, or become a sustaining donor, visit our website, WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Tobacco-Free Action of Columbia and Greene Counties. The more advertising kids see, the more likely they are to smoke or vape. To learn more and find out how you can help, rvwtobaccofree.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Will Ostro of Catskill, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Like a fire hydrant, like a public drinking fountain, like a park bench, WGXC is always there for you, at your service. 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
This is WGXC 90.7 FM podcasting here in Hudson, but we're transmitting from Acre, which is in Greene County, New York. Here in Hudson, where we are joined together, we're in Columbia County. So if you're listening locally, it's 90.7 FM radio. If you're listening globally, streaming, it's WGXC.org. And this is the podcast for August, The Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler, and we have a bevy of photographers here in the studio, and we have also on the line Paula Tognarelli, who has basically been responsible for bringing our four guests into the studio. And in the studio, we have Steve Gentelli.
Hello.
And Gail Albert.
Hi.
Liz Nealon.
Hello.
And Susan Higgins.
Hi.
They're all so, you know, posh and courteous. My goodness. It's going to be a great program. And Paula, welcome to the Art of the Hudson Valley.
Thank you for the invite, Chad. Very pleased.
And Paula, you are the director of photography and curator at the Griffin Museum in, is it Winchester, Massachusetts?
Yes. Yes, we're located in Middlesex County, just outside of Boston.
And you spend a lot of time as a juror for many shows around the world, aren't you?
I really do. You know, we do probably 49 exhibitions a year, and, you know, that takes a lot of an artist to fill those galleries. So I'm always on the hunt.
So for this, right now there's an exhibition that you jured, and it's there's an amazing 50 photographers with each having a work of art in the Davis Orton Gallery here in Hudson. What kind of experience was that? How many people submitted work, and how did you get to 50?
Well, I would say there was over 350 submissions.
Wow.
And each submission on average submitted 5 images each. And I usually use a specific process that I use, which is elimination. It takes a day at least to do that. I like to look at everything and then cull down to the images that I respond to, whether positively or negatively, because you never know why there's a negative reaction. And then I look at the work specifically as an entire body of work, looking at it as a whole, and that helps me call the show down to even more and get it to 50.
So you're actually looking at the, once you've culled it down, you're looking, it's kind of like a smorgasbord. When you see it out in front of you, you get a feeling of your appetite and what you see, and does the show kind of grow from within?
Well, when you get used to doing this kind of work, you see in a different way, and I also have a very broad aesthetic. So I'm not just looking for one kind of photograph. I have an appeal to a broad range of images. And I think I'm looking out for the audience as well. But the final decision is really how everything is assembled as a unit so that it works sequentially and as a feeling.
Are there trends that you like and don't like? And does that sort of color your curating skills?
No, I love photography. I live and breathe it on a daily basis. I will say that when I'm looking at submissions, that there definitely are trends that happen. You can almost predict what's happening in the world by what I see. And that surely came up during the Davis Horton exhibition. There's definitely something on the artist's mind. And in my statement, I mentioned it that, you know, you can look to the artists as beacons to what's happening in the world.
And
I saw a lot of emotion, for sure.
That's great. I noticed there's definitely a wide range of, there are photographs of people, there are abstracts, there are real-life situations, and That's kind of a difficult thing to do, in my opinion.
It may be for some, because we all don't learn the same. I happen to be a visual learner, and it's second nature for me. You know, standing up in front of an audience is not my forte, but reading imagery is. So thankfully, I have a job that's what I get to do on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think, and I... when we met at the Davis Horton Gallery reception, and I think you spoke a little bit about that, is, I mean, it's not easy for every person, especially, let's say we've got four photographers here in the studio and your experience with photography, to be a good writer, to be a good, you know, someone who can describe your own work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to do it all. There are very few people, and this afternoon we're going to find out from the four here what they're good at.
Right.
And I'll remind our listeners, the Davis Horton Gallery Juror Show is up now in Hudson. If you go to the website, davishortongallery.org, all the photographers are listed there with each of their work represented, and we'll make sure that's on the Facebook page for the Art of the Hudson Valley for our listeners.
I think it's .com.
.com?
Yep.
Thank you, Steve. People, you know, I have a good group of people in here who keep me straight. So, Steve, since you brought up my mistake, you're first up to describe yourself and to our listeners.
Okay. I'm a photographer. I've been photographing since about the age of 10. I'm now in my mid-50s, so that gives me 45 years of hopefully getting the 1,000 bad photographs out of my system numerous times. I got onto it, I think, because I had poor eyesight as a kid, and whenever we would see something pretty, everyone would say, how pretty, and to me it was just blurry. So I would grab the camera and say, oh, and pretend like it was so magnificently pretty. I had to get a photograph of it. When surreptitiously what I was doing was taking pictures so that later after the fact, when I got it magically developed, I could actually look at what everybody was oohing and aahing about. So I kind of became a delayed responder to the beauty in front of me from an early age.
And what about when I read your bio, you as a newspaper delivery boy?
Correct.
Having your camera with you wherever you went.
Yep. That came out of, that was a couple of years into it, and I just became so used to having the camera with me. I lived in a small rural town, so things were interesting, either more figurative work in terms of just the way that I don't know, trucks would park and cars would careen down roads and whatnot. I was an early morning delivery guy, so I was out there at about 5 o'clock in the morning before most of the town was awake. So I got to see it in that semi-quiet, semi-noisy, in a special way, place. And got to meet a lot of the town people and know a lot of their stuff by being out, you know, and in that special place where only, I guess, a news photographer delivery guy can be.
And how has your work grown from those early years to now?
Well, the last recent, it's moved quite a bit towards the, I guess, best described as abstract, although it's very realistic to me. The work would probably more profoundly fall in the category of abstract. But I was and still continue to be a landscape photographer. Not so much, I guess, a figurative photographer, although I learned that in recent years as well, too, to enjoy that. But I think that for me, I've always got that rural aesthetic plus the city. You know, my dad worked in New York and Manhattan, and I went to school at NYU. So that to me, and lived in New York before moving up here as well too, and worked. So I've always had that bipolar experience of the city life and the country life. Neither of which I think is completely winning the battle in for my heart. They both have a special place for different reasons.
I'm going to go to Susan Higgins.
Hi.
And let's hear your story. I'm sure you have one.
I do. Yes, definitely. Well, I had a 40-year career in academe that was initially based in New York City, where I was born and raised, and then moved to California, San Francisco, and then later on in Northern California. During that time, I had opportunity to take a number of cross-country trips, but also had an opportunity to observe my husband doing photography in Northern California, which piqued my interest. I always have been interested in taking pictures, and began that process a very long time ago, but never seriously. And I think I took it up seriously as a fine art photographer in about 2007, when we were still in San Francisco. And I was largely self-taught, but also took some workshops and studied at the RACO Center in San Francisco with a number of Bay Area photographers, Megan Rippenhoff to be most influential. And from there, I guess I'd have to say that I was just hooked on it. I greatly appreciated the immediacy of photography, and that greatly impressed me. That was kind of an essential feature. And I had no problem switching from using film to digital because of that feature, really. Mm. So I carry my camera with me all times. I largely shoot with an Nikon D300 and a Leica C, but I also increasingly rely on my iPhone, which I'm not afraid to use, and I think have become pretty adept at using. So I do that too. So for me, the photograph is a very personal encounter between me and an environment that I'm experiencing. I really focus on what I would call the physical landscape, American physical landscape and cultural landscape. And the two, to me, of course, are very much related. And from that, I draw what I feel are very familiar things that have an immediate sense of common experience among a viewership or pretty much anybody would recognize what it is that I'm interested in photographing. But I use that as a way to construct a larger story, a narrative about the American experience and where it has come from, where it is now, and where it might be in the future. So it's obviously from my very personal perspective. And as a process, I tend to shoot on the move with natural light. Every once in a while, more recently, I shoot in my studio and I construct a scene as opposed to shooting in passing. But I think they have all ultimately the same concept in mind, which is to take the viewer and have the viewer become part of that image and let them at that image speak to them and to their own personal history and perhaps have some connection between their own time and their own memories and where it takes them. So it's that personal perspective that I'm interested in, but also reflecting to me some of the tenets of our times.
Where are you living now?
Now I live right in Hudson.
Ah.
Yeah, yeah.
Lucky you.
Yes, lucky me. I'm very happy. We moved up here 5 years ago after returning from California. We didn't want to live in Manhattan anymore, and we had a little summer home in Stonington, Connecticut, which is a wonderful little village, a pre-revolution fishing village. And we loved living there, but it's quiet and it's isolated, so it really wasn't the place to be permanently. And a friend recommended coming up to Hudson. We wanted to be near the city and yet have the opportunity to open a door and walk and have a diverse community that had lots to offer. So Hudson is that place. I'm happy to be here.
And Gail Albert, welcome to the studio.
Hi. Good morning. Good afternoon.
I know. It's a good day.
Thank you.
It's always a good day. So let's hear a little bit about you. Where are you from?
I grew up in inner city Brooklyn and would have done anything to live in what I thought of as country. Although, except for one brief week or so when I was about 5, I didn't see country again until I was about 20. I saw my first cow at 21 and was horrified at how big it was. And I met the man who became my husband fairly when we were very young, still I was 17, and he used to camp as a kid. He grew up partly on a farm. So once we got together, and when I was around 19, I guess, we started doing some camping, and then we did a lot of travel out west in our 20s and later. And I was absolutely enthralled by particularly the West and Western landscape, but by landscape in general, and just awed and overcome by how incredibly beautiful the land was. And I started out in my 20s. I was in graduate school, and I got a PhD in experimental psychology. And my actual dissertation involved removing parts of the brain of rats to figure out what they then couldn't do in a particular way, which gave me nightmares. And it hadn't really occurred to me. I was fascinated by how the brain worked. And it didn't occur to me till I was actually in a lab what the experimentation in those years involved. And so I continued in the field for a while, but not that long after I finished my dissertation. I worked in a neurobiology lab for a while. And then was kind of between things and started photographing just to sort of have what to do almost. And I became a writer. And my first novel was actually a National Book Award finalist. And then I started writing another book. And in the middle of this, my husband became desperately ill, and he died in 1987. Mm. And although by then I had what was a career budding as a writer, I couldn't support my family, couldn't support my kids. So I ended up, in this very convoluted way, working on a program to bring mental health psychiatric services to mentally ill homeless people in New York City. And that was 10 years worth of administration and so on. And then I moved up to Woodstock from New York and continued for a while, another couple of years, in that arena in Ulster County. And along the way, had gotten licensed and through all sorts of training as a clinical psychologist. So I've done that for a number of years and continued photographing and took really wretched photographs. No natural talent is what I say. I had it for writing. I did not for photography. It was work.
Sometimes wretched is a positive word for photography or art in general, but I guess it's not what you're describing.
It wasn't, because people didn't see what I saw and what I was trying to photograph. And I was fascinated by complexity in the natural world. Doesn't matter. But then I ended up getting training as a teacher of Jewish meditation practice. And that's when my photography really started, really took off, I would say. So what I photograph now, it's not just the beauty of the world, but what I see is it sort of throbs with mystery and with presence. And the scientific background remains in there. So two things. I currently live with someone whose work has been largely in quantum physics. So one of the things he has told me recently, because it's been a fascination of mine forever, my kids used to have to listen to my reading aloud from books on quantum physics at the breakfast table, was that in every fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second, there are these particles that come into and out of existence. They're called virtual particles, and they're everywhere within every atom in the universe, in our bodies, everywhere. And if they were to stop coming in and out of nothingness, even for a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second, the entire physical universe would disappear. All the atoms would disappear. They'd go back into nothing. So for me, that has, as a meditator and as a religious person, actually, it's sort of the presence of what I think of as the divine, whatever that is, mystery, in the world all the time and permeating everything. And that's what I try to photograph.
Wow.
Yeah. And if you can feel at all what I feel when I look at a tree or a rock or anything, it's always the natural world, then I've succeeded in that photograph.
Have you ever done a narrative with your imagery?
Only as introductions, such as to the Wharton Gallery. No, I never have. And the other piece is that as a biologist, or partly sort of a biologist, I know that we all have one common ancestor, some single-celled creature way, 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 way back then. And everything evolved out of that. So we share DNA with everything on the planet. And when that really hit me a number of years ago, I started looking at tree bodies. And trees, as the bodies aged and grew and matured and aged and died. And the only difference is the time scale is generally different than it is for us. But it was seeing this mysterious creation in trees through their bodies. Yeah.
Great. And now I'm going to introduce Liz Nealon to the program.
Hello.
Hi, Liz. So, welcome. Let's hear your story. We're doing so good right now.
Well, good. I'll try to keep it going. I've been working in media my whole career. I was doing a master's in journalism at NYU when I got a call from somebody who said, you know, there's this new television channel starting, and they're going to do music, and they want people that can write. And you should interview there. So I did, and I ended up on the startup team at MTV Music Television. Mm. And I was there for, I really learned television then from the ground up, because I was a writer. I wasn't a television producer. But eventually I became the head of MTV International, and I traveled all over the world starting MTV on other continents. So it really, I spent 11 years seeing the world. I always had my camera with me. Mm. Worked in television and went from MTV to Sesame Workshop, where I eventually became the creative director of Sesame Street. So I've worked in media for a long time. And the last series that I did was shot in Australia. It was a series for older kids. And, you know, when you're a television producer, you're always, especially at the beginning of a series, you've cast the actors, you're setting it up, you're sitting next to the director, and you're talking about lighting, you're talking about framing, you're developing a look for that series. And I remember the casting director was on set one day, and she said to me, you know exactly what you want to see. Why are you not a director? Well, I didn't really want to be a television director. That's sort of a different, the producer's in charge in television. Yeah. I like to be in charge. So I didn't really want to be a television director, but it really made me start to think more seriously about my photography. And moving, I think I've always had a pretty good eye, and I've taken a lot of beautiful pictures, beautiful landscapes, beautiful flowers. But what I'm working on now is, for first of all, really knowing the camera in manual, which I'm getting better and better at, I think, but also having a distinct point of view when I take a photograph. So if I decide to photograph a landscape, why is my point of view on that photograph different than the way one of you who are here with me might photograph that landscape? And I think that's really the quest that I'm on. This is my third juried show, so I'm making a little bit of progress, I think.
Great.
And it was funny. The other night, my photograph is, technically it's a pair of old brick steps. It's just steps. But a number of people have said to me, you know, that looks like a sandwich. I thought that was a hamburger. And I'm like, good. I think I got like a unique point of view on these steps. So I think that's, like I said, I've been in media forever. And I really love both written and visual media. And I'm just really I feel at my best creative self when I'm photographing. So I'm really taking it serious. I'm working still as a literary agent, actually, on the side. Photographing on the side. But I'm really starting to get better at it, I think. And I'm studying with Joan Lifton, who happens to be my cousin by marriage. And Joan is a wonderful photographer. She's a very well-known photo editor. She's edited a lot of big photo books. And she headed the International Center for Photography. Mm. So Joan has been really pushing me. Yeah, that's nice, but that's what's your point of view? So that's what I'm working at, and really enjoying it.
Well, Paula, can I bring you in for a moment?
Sure.
So you've heard four photographers who are all diverse. Is this typical, what you've heard in speaking with other photographers, their backgrounds, their inspirations?
Well, I think everybody is varied in their direction and how they form their photo life. I find it interesting to speak to photographers at all stages in their life, because we're always emerging or re-emerging in our artistic life. So yes, I think it's a common conversation I have with many artists and photographers.
Do you like work that has a continual story or storyline? Because I think it shows up in a lot of photojournalism, and sometimes people who do landscapes and portraits. But is the life of a photographer growing, or should they, once they find a niche, should they stay there?
Well, it's a personal question to the photographer, and I think to the curator. I find that I don't have expectations that somebody is going to continue a body of work for the rest of their life. I don't have expectations that someone will always do the same type of photography all their life. I find that people change as they start a project and then pursue another. And I'm okay with that. I don't pigeonhole, and I don't look to pigeonhole. Some do. Like, some people always want to keep someone in a photojournalistic style. I really do think you can bounce as long as the body of work you're working on and showing is developed and polished. There's no reason that you can't stop it and go on to another body of work. That's my personal opinion.
Well, I would also imagine from your point of view, there's a different role of being a juror and then someone who sits down for a portfolio review.
Yes. I mean, I do many reviews with photographers who are also our members, and they're at all different stages. And while somebody would go on and tell me that they're not ready for this review, I say, that's not so. As a professional, I am able to talk about your work at whatever stage that you're at. And I think that most people like myself, who this is what we do for a living, should be able to do this. So it's not always that I have the luck of looking at 15 to 20 pieces of artwork, photographs that are culled with a purpose in mind, it's wonderful to do that, but it doesn't always happen. A lot of photographers don't even have prints at some point, so that I'm looking at the computer screen. And I think we need to be that facile as people that help photographers pursue what their goals are.
Yeah, I would certainly agree. I'm going to switch to our guests to sort of respond to that, because I think that's a refreshing point of view that you've just mentioned, Paula. And
yeah,
a lot of photographers are good at prints, and many aren't. Many use Instagram as their platform, and some use their laptops as their portfolio. And so I'm going to, Susan, how do you like showing your work, and how do you get the best response?
That's a good question. That's not, I wasn't thinking along those lines, but
that's
I just wanted to say to Paula that I completely agree with her that it's that if you stayed static, I think that you would crumble under your own weight. I do think that your photography expresses who you are at that moment in time.
Yes.
And what skill subset you have and what experiences you have. Mm. When I first started doing my photography, I was really learning to master the camera and to capture what I thought I was capturing and make sure my image said what it was. But mostly, could I use this camera to produce that image, if you will? And I learned, so my body of work has changed dramatically over my, along with my skill at using the camera and having the camera be second nature to what I want to try to express. There are things I'm doing now that I couldn't have done 10 years ago, just not possible, because of my vision and my maturity in using the camera. I always printed my own work. So, I mean, I did start using Price Club or something like that in California. But what I found was that you're then putting, for me personally, I was putting my work in somebody else's hands to make decisions about color and perhaps tonalities or interrelationships that I felt I wanted to be able to control. So very early on, I took some workshops on Photoshop to be able to use that, and I was very happy that I did that. So it's my digital darkroom, if you will. And I always printed my own work, and I still do. And I like to choose my paper carefully for the topic, and I might do 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 takes on any one image before I get it just right. So how do I show my images? I prefer to show the print, because the print says it all to me. Mm. Whether or not my image needs to have textured paper or smooth paper or heavyweight or vellum or whatever, I know that hard copy expresses really what I want to say. On the other hand, when you look at your images on a screen, they look alive, you know. Mm. They look wonderful. And they have this backlight, so it's like, oh my gosh, that's so vibrant. And then you print it, and it can just die.
Yes.
So I think that getting what is on your screen to be on a print is itself kind of a growing talent. So if I had to show somebody images, sure, I'd show images on a computer or even on my cell phone. But if you really wanted to appreciate the art, for me, I would rather show the print.
Steve, I'm going to go back to you and get your sort of take on that.
Well, I grew up in the age of the darkroom, black and white more so than color. I never did color at home. I didn't have the patience. I also didn't have the lung capacity for it or the budget, honestly. But I did have a little black and white darkroom. I also had one in the school as well, too, that I took advantage of. And I also had the local druggist in town also developed as well, too. And we grew up to have a great rapport because of that. It was the age where snooping was allowed, so he, seeing me come in with 3 rolls of film every week, would develop them and, started to take an interest in, well, what is this kid shooting, photographing so profoundly? And through that got to meet Eddie Adams, who has a workshop out in Sullivan County. And I didn't know who Eddie Adams was. I just knew him as Eddie the photographer, who was there on Saturday mornings after I collected my monies. I bought my baseball cards and bubble gum and picked up my film because I finally had money to do that. And Eddie started looking at my work as well, too. as on his journey out to Jeffersonville. And again,
one of the
most famous
photojournalists.
Yeah, I didn't know who he was. I just knew that he was Eddie, and he had a cool camera and a big boy camera. You know, he had a big lens and all this other stuff. And it was exciting to me to find somebody. My dad was a CPA and had limitations onto his understanding of creativity and expressing that. To him, a pencil was always a pencil. My mom encouraged my writing and my creative work usually on the walls of the house from an early age. She okayed that. But that was, for me, it became my language. You know, I'm in a show that Paul is juried up in Boston as well, Mother Tongue. And for that show, I was approached by two photographers to write poems to their photographs instead of to collaborate with them photographically. And I found that to be incredibly honorable that both of them recognized me both as a writer as well as a fellow photographer. And it was a wonderful experience to do. The show is fantastic. I encourage you to go see it before it comes down mid-September. but that was a big wow. For me, I don't know. I think that it depends. I've grown so used to, I think, seeing it electronically, either on the back of the camera or the phone or the computer screen, that I tend to leave the finer printing of stuff to people that are better inclined. You've interviewed Richard Edelman before, who's a local photographer. And he's an absolute master with the photographic print. I couldn't even touch what Richard is able to do. So I know my limitations there. I'm also partially colorblind as well, too, which is also a challenge, which is why I don't use Photoshop a lot, because some of the colors come out. You know, I live near Woodstock, and it puts Woodstock to a real challenge if I start tweaking with the colors. So, but I enjoy all that we can do now. I mean, to think that I used to have to hold myself up in a little dark room and keep the door closed, and now I could do that in broad daylight is just magical to me. The capacity to store all that material is both frightening. You know, when I lost my flash drive recently, I was utterly panicked because they're so small and they contain so much information. It's like, oh my God, there's 2 years worth of photographs on that drive. You know, it is what it is. But this is just a gracious age that we live in. Being able to do that as we do it, I think, makes it that much more fun, challenging, and really pushes the limits too. To not make me lazy because of that, it really the different papers are just, oh my goodness, I could go on and on. I am. Shut up.
Well, I'm going to go to Liz, who saw a lot of imagery in broadcasting, which, you know, we all have had experience, you know, looking at a screen or, excuse me, a television screen or a movie screen and just being awed by seeing a visual storyline. How has it been for you to sort of transition your photography? And where do you like to see it and show it?
In terms of transitioning, it's really the same thing. You know, you're still looking at what's the available light? Do I need to supplement that light? You know, what kind of angle do I want? I mean, it's all the same thing. I don't find it that different. But it did make me kind of a digital animal, I think. I shot on film, 16mm film, for a while. But television long ago went to digital, so... Mm. I'm really comfortable with all sorts of, you know, I also worked at MTV where we were really pioneering in those early days what we were doing with the animations and the way we were, the way they talked to us at MTV in the early days was if a person is changing the channel and they look at MTV for 2 seconds, they should know by who's on that screen, by the colors that are on that screen, by the way it is framed, by the way it is cut, they should know that that is for them. If they're 18 to 24 years old. Mm. So that's a really rigorous discipline to get that in 2 seconds. So I'm definitely a digital animal. I love Instagram because I find that I use Facebook for more of a personal connecting with friends, but Instagram I really use as a photographer. LizTheWiz518 is my name on Instagram. And the wonderful thing there is that you connect with other photographers. You follow them, they follow you, and there's all sorts of really interesting work being posted all the time. So I find that a wonderful way to see what my peers are up to and learn from them. And get feedback, too, because I'll put up something I think is great and nobody responds. I'm like, okay, maybe not so great. So I like that. And as you said, Susan, I also... Sometimes I just use my phone. I have an Android phone, but the Samsung camera is fantastic. And a couple of months ago, I was trying to take a photograph, and I really, it needed to be on manual, and I only had my phone. I saw a scene, and I wanted to grab it. And I was like, you know, I bet I can go on manual. And sure enough, I dug through in the settings, and you can get into manual on your phone and have a lot more control than at least I had realized until then.
Oh, for everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a real camera.
That's right.
So, you know, I'm comfortable with digital.
You know, talking about smartphones as a device, I consider them cameras. I mean, everything's a camera, whether they're using a view camera or Instamatic or, you know, anything. I don't see personally anything wrong with doing your career on a smartphone. If you can make it work, that's all that matters.
It's just a different tool.
That's right.
It's just a different tool.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like
a camera's a tool.
Yeah, it's you know, I grew up with, you know, where the lens was king. You know, my first camera was one that I went down to New York, you know, with my dad, and was an accountant, and during tax season, and I saw in one of the camera shops there near his office in Times Square, saying that's the camera that I want. You know, it's a big boy camera, and it's a Voigtlander, you know, and I didn't know from names or whatever, but I thought it looks cool, and it had, you know, it was simple, but looked like it could do the job, you know, and I still have the camera now. It's a Voigtlander Vito C, you know, and it's got a fixed lens, and it's like, I still throw film through it every once in a while, you know, but again, it's just a matter of the tools of it. I know I went to NYU because I wanted to take my still photography and I wanted to tell stories. So I wanted to become a storyteller and a documentary filmmaker in that regard. So that's why I went to NYU, was to further that education and to take that storytelling the next step. So,
Gail, I want to... Thank you, Steve. Yep. I wanted to go to Gail because I do recall that Twisted Tree that you have. It's very strong, and to me that's just one image that I've seen of yours, which is nature. Do you like to verge and veer off into people? And
no.
All right, I'm glad I asked that question.
In general, no, I'm only interested in the natural world. And again, hoping to convey what I experience when I'm out in the woods or wherever. It could be anywhere. I don't have an iPhone. I have an Android with supposedly a very good camera. And for me, although I've seen other people take wonderful photographs, I don't get the photographs I want without using my Nikon, I have to say. And I still remember a number of years ago, I was in a workshop with someone class, and I said very proudly, oh, I don't do any post-processing. And he was incredible because instead of, he didn't even, there was no inkling of a sneer on his face. He just said, really? And I ended up being mentored by him for about a year. His name is Glenn DeWitt. He's wonderful. So I also really like to be able to do whatever is needed with Photoshop or Lightroom to get the image to look in a way that others, again, will see it the way I saw it. I don't want people to see exactly a tree when they look at the photograph you look at. They should see the tree, and they should also go, oh, it is a torso, because that's what it's called. It is a torso, yes. And what I find fascinating with post-processing is, firstly, once I realized that even Ansel Adams' photographs that we saw printed were nothing like the ones he actually took. He took out whole. There's a famous one where he took out the billboard. It's one of his most famous, iconic photographs. That was a shock for me and gave me permission to then eliminate whatever in the picture, the house that I didn't really want in there. I take snapshots when I go hiking, and I have a ton of travel photographs like that, but I don't tend to show those. And I have a website, which is the only way you're going to find me, is gailalbert.com. And I love it when people look online. As Susan said, on the computer, things look incredible, incredible. They pop. But I love working with printing and seeing how to translate what the computer showed, again, as much as possible into a print that really has that same quality of being alive, because it's different if someone can actually stand and look at the print. It's more present in some... It's different. I shouldn't say it's more present, but it's different. So I keep learning about printing. The other thing I wanted to say, that I know I'm not alone on this, is that the act of... We all want to have the other person's, the viewer, see what we saw when we took the photograph, right? But what's fascinating is that as one does post-processing, the tools at this point in Photoshop or Lightroom, say, are so extensive that you can end up with 10 different versions, or whatever number, of that same photograph. And after a while, the question becomes, what did I see almost? Yeah. Because they're just slightly different, but they convey something a little not the same. And it's subtle, but it's there. And it's a real dilemma of getting lost in the process. You know, I often at this point sit with my, up there is my initial photograph untouched, you know, so I can go back to, oh, that's what I saw in my brain.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I see you're looking at me as you're saying this. Yes. I think that is the danger, is you can really get carried away with all of the processing.
Yeah.
That's why I think, as a photographer, it's always important to take that original image and not touch it. Archive it and make copies and then work from there. But
there's also a piece in the show, too, that's it's not disparaging the photograph at all, but it's obvious that it's been the one, I'm forgetting the photographer's name, he deals with Vietnam vets and PTSD, the sunflower photograph. Mm. That's to me... seeing it, I thought that was both bold to enter that, because drew me to having to read his statement as well too, and knowing Paula as well too, to say it's interesting that Paula would choose that, and there's got to be a reason for that as well too. And to look at that photograph and say there's a place for that in today's world. That shouldn't be excluded as bad or a mistake or an error or a rip up and throw in the trash and recycle, but that's a deliberate, obvious choice that we now can make easily as we're doing it in our house versus, you know, sending it out to the printer to say, oh, no, that's not what we wanted, Clark Labs. We wanted you to really blow out the, you know, overexpose it by 3 stops, okay? Yeah, I know what I'm doing. Please do that. Please.
Although as much as possible, I think at least for me, you want to try to capture it in the camera.
Hmm.
That's right.
Well,
to do that where you don't crop that you crop in the camera.
Absolutely.
I think that helps create just a better quality image in general, and it forces your eye to be a little bit more refined in capturing what you want to capture. So I think that's really important. I hear what you're saying about acceptance of an image for what it's worth at a certain point in time. I really do agree with that. But I also think that if you... I save all of my original images unaltered, mm-hmm. and those I back up.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I always can go back to that original image if the camera... Whatever. They're not going to be lost. I have them off-site. But what I like to do when I'm working on Photoshop is... try to express within the image what I want to say at that moment. So looking at those subtle differences between things that you might do might work for one purpose and not for others.
Exactly.
So you just have to stay true to what, to me, is what your purpose is at that point in time. And I find that some images can get overworked, too sharp, hyper sharp, hyper color, too saturated. Although some people like that, and that's fine. But I think you have to know what you want to say, and then which of those multiple images, and it's infinite, expresses most closely what you want to do at that moment in time. And that's you have to know yourself to do that, right?
Yeah,
I think that's a good thing.
I agree with that. And also, I at least, although I haven't been doing it as yet, I love being able to do collage-type work and introducing more than one image and playing with that, which mm-hmm. wasn't the original. Mm-hmm. And often, I must say, with my tree photographs, which are not landscapes, they're portraiture. And I think when I do them, I've been much more influenced by painting than by photography in my life. I spent much more time at museums looking at paintings. And as with portraiture in paintings, I don't necessarily want the same background as was originally in the photograph. What I'm interested in is the body that I'm taking a portrait of. But I may then, as you'll see if you look online at gailabbert.com, I don't necessarily have the same background as was originally in there. Mm. The photograph you're talking about was in a very uninteresting parking lot, and it didn't work compositionally, and it would distract the viewer from the torso. Right. So it now has a background of the other trees that were in the woods beyond the parking lot, but that couldn't be in that picture.
And so did you know at the moment you took that picture, did you shoot the background knowing you needed the background?
Yes. Yeah. I did it the same, the same time, same day. Yes, absolutely. It's actually, yes. I also attempted to mask the background in the photograph and have it all black. So if you had been there, you would have seen me struggling with 10 feet of black cloth that I was trying to get up there in the wind that kept falling. Oh, I looked ridiculous.
Oh, you mean me this morning with that?
Right. And that's when I realized this has to be done as post-processing. It's not a studio, and I can't carry what would be needed.
Well, one of the things I like about the show at Davis Orton is the overall photograph of the little 50 images as a mosaic. And Paula, I want to ask you about, because we've sort of been talking about the selection process, and from my point of view, I mean, from your point of view is much different. You're the professional. How did you choose, from a tree to an abstract to all these different images and just know it works?
Well, I actually put all the images into a software program that I can arrange, that I can make a show right in front of me, and that's what I do. I put images side by side, it's an extra process. It takes a lot of time, but I think that's the difference between voting for one particular image and not looking at anything else. The end result, I think, is much more rewarding for me as the juror, but also, I think, for the audience. And I sometimes think that people don't even know why they like it so much, but there's actually relationships built into the show so that they're responding in a way that they don't even know intuitively.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And were you and Karen responsible for the placement of each image on the walls?
Yes. I sent her my final results, and I show it in a sequence. And then I told her that I understand that, sometimes you can't arrange a show exactly how someone wants it, but to honor relationships. So she, within her space, worked with what I had given her and made it fit the actual room. So we worked together and with that. So she made decisions based on what I provided, and sometimes she had to change those, but she did an excellent job, I think, laying it out on the wall.
It's quite beautiful to see all the different images together, and I think most people would just say, I don't want to be a part of that process. I'm just surprised. I want to be surprised to see where I show up in that exhibition.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, there's a lot of movement going on. If you look at the shapes that are mimicked repeatedly in some cases. There's a unity in color. I mean, I think it was you that pointed out that there was a lot of yellow. And I think that that is true. I think that it came through in what people were submitting. It's summer, it's beautiful, it's warm, and what color comes through. I think that what I find so exciting is to see photographers that are opposite sides of the continent, not in communication with each other, but having thoughts that are similar to someone else. I mean, that is just like a miracle. They're not copying each other. They've never had a discussion, and yet their topic or their images, it's like they were connected.
It's that world vibe coming together.
Yes.
Which we have you to be responsible for, and also the submissions of the 50 wonderful photographers who participated.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, Paula, what's up next for you?
Well, we're like a machine at the Griffith. It's like I have to laugh. I say, party platter to go. It's in my car. So this has been an interesting week for me. We were at the reception with you on Saturday, and then I came home to an opening reception and another reception, and tonight I have an event with the Winchester Cultural Council. Tomorrow I have another opening at one of our galleries in the South End, and soon I'm going to vacation right after that.
Well deserved, it sounds like.
Yeah, this business can burn you out easily, even though we love it so much.
Well, Paula, we're wrapping up here. I want to, I'm going to continue for the next couple of minutes talking to our four guests in the studio. I want to thank you for your participation on the Art of the Hudson Valley podcast, and really appreciate your talent and what you've done with the Davis Dorton Gallery exhibition. And I know you'll be out there doing more, and we'll have to watch to see where you show up next so we can submit.
Oh, that's nice. And I hope I am back at Davis Dorton. Those two galleries are wonderful people. They're very ethical and polished and professional.
And one
so
of the
thank
few,
you for inviting me.
One of the few photography galleries around.
Yes, that's good.
Thank you, Paul.
So honor them. Get people to them. Okay. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Paula.
So, listeners, you've been listening to The Art of the Hudson Valley. We have a few more minutes to talk to our remaining four photographers. I kind of will follow what I said asked with Paula is what's next. So, Susan, what's next?
Well, first after hearing what everybody's been doing with their websites, I have to update my website. But I invite you to see it. It's shigginsphotography.com, and it is a retrospective of my work. So it's work that I think goes back to 2010. And so I think it talks about that developmental process that I had mentioned earlier. But I'd like to include some extra work there. I'm represented in the flat file in the New Haven art space. And that has a number of images from a project that I did on handwork, thread fiber handwork that speaks to color selections, if you will, and nostalgia and using thread and tulle. So that I invite you to see that too. So those two things, my website and continuing to show my work.
And Gail, in these last few seconds, I'm sorry to get you down. So where can we find your work?
GailAlbert.com. And I've been in other juried shows, but in recent months I've gotten such praise at portfolio reviews that I've gone to that I've begun submitting to a lot more places. So I don't know anywhere right now beside Davis Horton, but we'll see.
And Liz?
I see you're wrapping, so I'll just say that you can see my work at LizNeeland.com. And I'm working right now on a series on water that I've been shooting for a number of years. I'm just
great.
Fast. I live in Copaic Lake year-round. I'm around water all the time, and I'm just going to keep shooting it until I get to where I want to be.
Good. Mm-hmm. Keep going. And Steve, finally.
I'm taking a bit of a break in terms of the hardcore application of work to possibilities right now. I'm a little tired, and I'm just catching up with the reality of my life that needs some attention, and loving my dog as much as possible.
Nice.
You can't beat it. He's a wonderful guy. My website is imagesg.com. And I'm trying to get that current and up and running. Facebook is a big winner. You could see most of the public stuff there. And you'll just see me around Woodstock, Saugerties, and occasionally Gramercy Park.